This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert.
Are there any questions I can answer before we get going here? Yes, ma'am, I saw you first in the middle.
Yeah, I was just wondering who came up with the bit about, it's kind of a long-running bit, where you asked people from the audience, or you asked people for fans, to make up names for the ex-president, so you wouldn't have to say his name anymore.
I think we saw, Tom, how did that start? We saw some online, people, we made up some.
Well, what happened was...
This is Tom Purcell, my showrunner. Tom, come on out here.
So what happened was, Stephen, you said emotionally you never want to say his name again.
That's right, yeah.
Right, and...
I believe that was after November 5th, 2020, yeah.
Yeah, and in a script that Matt Lappin and I were working on,
we decided
to just throw it in there and see what happened.
Right.
Of like
inviting the audience.
Yeah, inviting the audience to do it at this hashtag.
Yes. And he who must not be named.
Yeah, and then we threw it up there, and we've
got thousands of them.
Yeah,
now.
We were thinking that nobody would really be into it, and like
everybody's
well,
into
people
it.
Were into it.
So that's how it started. Thank you, Tom. Yes, on the end here, young lady, yes, in the cream jacket or whatever, beige, yes.
Hi.
Oatmeal, hello.
I was wondering if there's anything you missed about filming from home.
Anything I miss about filming from home? The commute. Also, the bar is very close when the show's over. And also, just hanging out with Ev, you know, hanging out with Evie. Like, it's really nice when we're really literally shooting from home, because we shot upstairs in a storeroom for 10 months, too. But for the first 5 months from home, my crew was my middle son, who was a, you know, radio, television, and film major at Northwestern. And so when we bugged out and went to South Carolina, we're like, I can't have crew come into my house. We don't know what's going on, because no one knew anything about contagion or anything like that. And Tom goes, isn't your son a radio, television, and film major at Northwestern? Why doesn't he just run everything? And so he was my crew, and then he said, Dad, I won't graduate from college if I keep doing this for you. So his younger brother took over, who was a senior in high school, and he did that for a month, and he goes, Dad, I won't graduate from high school if I keep doing this for you. So then Evie took over for the last 3 months, and that was great. You know, all I ever wanted was her as my audience anyway, you know, because the best laughs ever from her. And so she was there, and my boys were literally doing their homework while the show was going on, so they never paid attention to the show. They were just getting, you know, cues from, like, I don't know, Kamal or whoever was talking to them on the headsets from up here on the virtual control room we had. So being with your family, you know, it was like a 19th century where everybody comes down to the mill to help Dad, you know, work. It was like that. It felt very old-fashioned. Yes, over there. Yes, ma'am, right there. For the record, I'm not that crazy about The Hobbit. I like The Lord of the Rings. I like Silmarillion. I'm not, Hobbit's like, it's okay. What books made me a reader? Well, I mean, literally, I'm old enough, and the schools that I went to school in South Carolina were poorly funded enough that when I was a kid, I still had Dick and Jane books. See Spot Run, Run Spot Run. You know, I had all that. And so, I mean, they didn't make me a reader. What did I love? I loved, books of mysteries and spooky stories when I was a little kid. And then when I was 10, I really, really hit the gas pedal when I discovered science fiction. The first book that I read in that regard, besides like Wrinkle in Time or something like that, was The Long Arm of Gil Hamilton by Larry Niven. No one. Okay. No one actually read Larry Niven. You read The Long Arm of Gil Hamilton? Did anyone read The Long Arm of Gil Hamilton by Larry Niven? Nope, you didn't. But I read that, then I ended up reading everything by Larry Niven. He became my guy, my intro to science fiction. And then I read everything by, not everything by Asimov, you can't read everything by Asimov, but everything by Heinlein, all that juvenile science fiction by Heinlein. And then I read a ton of Asimov and Fred Paul and A.E. Van Vogt and Jack Vance and Henry Kuttner and really deep cut, like, golden age science fiction guys, John W. Campbell, people like that. So I just ate my way through. I'm the youngest of 11 children, and my eldest two brothers bought those books when they came out in the 1950s. And I read all their leftovers when I was a kid. So I had enormous library of classic science fiction that I read. And then I got into tons of fantasy. Yes, ma'am. I can't see. Yes, sir. In the middle of the back.
I was wondering what your first comedy gig was.
For my brothers and sisters. I'm one of 11 children. And so I'm the youngest of 11. So my family was always the audience. I just wanted to be them, be like them. But the actual first time I ever got paid to do comedy, when was my first thing? It was at a place called Cross Currents, a club that doesn't exist anymore in Chicago. They used to be under the L Belmont L, and that's no way. Belmont or Cross Currents? You went to Cross Currents? Were you Were you an improviser or a day drinker? Because those are the only two people who went to Cross Currents. What? What were you? You just went there. It was a club. Wow. Okay. So I performed at Cross Currents. That was the first time I went down there to see Del Close and Sharna Halpern and people do the Herald Improv, which at the time, Improv Olympic was really young. And I went down there to see what it was. And I saw it. And I went, I have to do this. I don't know what this is, but I have to do this long form improvisation. And that changed my life. A friend of mine, a guy named Chris Paff, said, "You want to come down and see this thing? It's improvised one act plays." And I said, "How do you do that?" And then I saw how you do that, and I was completely hooked. And I performed there about a month later for the first time with my own group, which was called the No Fun Mud Piranhas. That was the name of our improv group, the No Fun Mud Piranhas. You're right there, front row.
Hey, Stephen, how are you doing tonight?
That's a question. I'm doing great. Let's move on. What's your question, ma'am?
Do you want to run the marathon with me next year?
Do I want to run the marathon? Could I get an epidural first? Right there in the middle. You, ma'am, right there. Yes. You, ma'am. Yes.
What Sondheim role would you most want to play?
What Sondheim role would I most want to play? I mean, who wouldn't want to play George in Sonny in the Park with George? I mean, that would be a fantastic... That's kind of when I first fell in love with Sondheim. I already knew his work, but I really fell in love with him when I saw Sonny in the Park with George. And I remember when I was a young guy, and I wasn't in theater school, but I read the lyrics to Finishing a Hat to my mother to try to explain to her why I wanted to try to go be an artist. Because that idea of, you know, the romance and the sort of spiritual impulse toward creation that's described, that's sort of inexplicable except through poetry, that he describes in that, moved me more than anything I'd ever seen or read. And that was really what pushed me into this life that I live now. So I'd probably want to play George, but you need Mandy Patinkin range to play that. And anybody? Yes, ma'am, right there.
How is COVID changing
your personal
friendship?
How is what?
COVID.
How has COVID done what? I'm not sure any of us have had enough time to figure that out yet. You know what I mean? It was a tragedy. It was what it was.
Yeah.
It was a shock, you know. And they say like a major tragedy, shock to your system, catastrophic or traumatic injury, that sort of thing. It takes 7 years to get perspective on it. So I can't begin to think that I have the truth of it. I'll say this: it changed how I feel about y'all. Because I missed you a lot. I always liked an audience. But I always really loved, one of the reasons I took this job, because I knew this job was gonna be a challenge, was that the ability to be with live people every night. You know, that's a real privilege to be in a Broadway house and do a show in front of these live people, to have this extraordinary band to play with on a given night over here. And, but man, not having you for 15 months, don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you got till it's gone. And it changed how I felt about talking to people. Like, my interview with Bono, which is going to be tonight, would have been very different 3 years ago. I would not be as relaxed and take it as slowly and like, just keep pushing as much. Interviewing people over Zoom taught me to just make it a conversation, you know, which I was able to do at times before, but now it's always my first my first objective is to do that. Interviews, which are great and always surprising and improvisational, for me, my enjoyment of them has just gone through the roof. That's one of the biggest ways. Personally, I've reached out to a lot of old friends that I didn't have time, I thought, before, and now somehow I do. Anybody up here? Yes, sir, front row. My favorite interview I've ever done on the show? Wow, I've been really lucky. I've interviewed a lot of very interesting people. I interviewed, I enjoy interviewing presidents. That's a lot of fun. I really enjoy, sort of pound per pound, like solid, you know I'm gonna have a good time. Neil deGrasse Tyson's very hard to beat. John Oliver's very hard to beat for an interview. That's a ton of fun. Tig Notaro, who's on tonight, is a ton of fun. I really like Michael Shannon, who's on here tonight, too. I would say that the most meaningful interview I've ever done was the Reverend Ambassador Andrew Young, who was a great civil rights leader and also mayor of Atlanta, U.S. Congressman and Ambassador to the U.N., because he knew my dad. And I didn't know he knew my dad. But when the writers went on strike in 2007 for the old show, I called my brother Ed and said, what am I going to do here? How do I get through this in the best possible way? Respectful to my writers, but still keeping everybody else employed and everything. And he goes, well, you should stay communicating with your writers. That's an important thing to do. You know, you should talk to Andrew Young about this. And I said, why would I talk to Andrew Young about this? And he goes, don't you know about Andrew Young and Dad? I said, no. And he goes, Andrew Young, the hospital workers went on strike. My father was an administrator of a hospital in South Carolina. In 1969, he'd only been on the job for like 2 weeks, come down from Washington, took this job. And the hospital workers all went on strike. And Andrew Young and Ralph Abernathy and Coretta Scott King were with the striking hospital workers. And my father was on the administration side. And Andrew Young, and he wasn't the head of the hospital, Andrew Young, who wasn't the lead on the striking side, Andrew Young and my father went off inside rooms and they would keep talking every day and go, okay, how do we settle this? What do we need to do? And they settled the strike between the two of them privately with the understanding that no one could ever know that they had worked this out because neither side was willing to back down. So they worked something out that satisfied both sides. And I didn't know it, and nobody knew that until I went on air and had Andrew Young come on, and he told me the story of my father's work with him. And that was probably the most meaningful story. You ready to do it? Y'all ready to do the show?
Yes.
Y'all ready to do the show?
Happy holidays from The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. We're dropping your favorite Colbert classics with the biggest stars until we're back on January 3rd with all new episodes. Watch The Late Show with Stephen Colbert weeknights at 11:35, 10:35 Central on CBS and Paramount Plus. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and subscribe to The Late Show on YouTube for exclusive content and more.
I'm Rachel Martin. After hosting Morning Edition for years, I know that the news can wear you down. So we made a new podcast called Wild Card, where a special deck of cards and a whole bunch of fascinating guests help us sort out what makes life meaningful. It's part game show, part existential deep dive, and it is seriously fun. Join me on Wildcard, wherever you get your podcasts. Only from NPR.
Jon Stewart is back at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition wherever you get your podcasts.